Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Just 2 months ago, it looked like the Oregon legislature was poised to pass a slew of civil rights, environmental, and equity bills. But this agenda was blindsided first by Republican legislators who once again fled the state to protest the cap-and-trade bill. Their move shut down the session 3 days early, preventing the passage of over 100 other bills. On the heels of that fiasco, the COVID-19 virus arrived in Oregon, shutting down the rest of our life as we know it. Today we talk with Karen Power, Oregon State Representative for District 41, who sponsored several of the session's stillborn bills. We'll talk about what happens now to that agenda in the face of this pandemic. Karen, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you, and good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you during this very strange time. I'm thinking back, it was like maybe a millennia ago, back in February when we first talked about doing this interview. And I want to go back to that time that seems so far away now and think about what was on the agenda then and how it all got derailed.
It's hard to believe that we were in session less than a month ago. It feels like it's been much, much longer than that. And I know most people probably feel that way as well.
So what were some of the issues that were on the agenda?
We had a number of important funding bills. The state was facing a much different financial situation then, with our economy about as strong as it's ever been. And so the legislature was poised to make significant investments in housing and services, in emergency shelters, a number of different much needed areas. As well as, as you mentioned, dozens of policy bills that colleagues, stakeholders, and advocacy organizations have been working on, some for more than a year.
And then there was the infamous cap-and-trade bill, which was the catalyst, I guess, for the Republicans to flee the state at the end of February.
Yeah, so the Senate took up the policy in the fall of 2019 after the Republican walkout in the 2019 session. And a group of senators had been working to hear some of the Republican concerns, do their best to address those while still keeping the core of a bill together to begin to address Oregon's contribution to global warming. The end form of the bill would have largely exempted Eastern Oregon and started in our most populated areas in the near term. And it still managed to retain the largest group of labor, utility, environmental, and business stakeholders in support of it. Unfortunately, the Republicans ultimately decided their constituents wanted them to leave the state rather than to allow Democrats to vote on the bill. So we didn't do any further business other than the three bills that passed the 2020 session.
So I guess to a lot of people's surprise, you wound up shutting down the session a few days early. Why was that?
Well, it became clear that the Republicans were not going to return in time for us to complete the work. My colleagues in the House side, the Republicans, left at the same time that the Senate was going to be considering the cap and trade bill. So no work got done on either chamber, even though it would have been at least a week longer before the bill made its way over to the House. We had about 5 days worth of work to do in order to finish everything up. And with just a couple of days left, it was clear that the Republicans were not going to come back in time to complete that work.
When you look back at that now, in light of what we're going through, I mean, what are some of your thoughts about that time that was so amazingly wasted?
Gosh, we are just operating in such a different space right now. We had information towards the end of session about the scale of the infection rates in China and elsewhere, but not quite an idea of how infectious it was going to be and how quickly the disease was going to spread. So we were still focused on the business before Oregon at the time. We had, among our colleagues, as you remember, some of us and some of my colleagues have served with each other across party lines for years and years. So we get to know each other as people, get to know each other's families a bit. Really difficult. That was a really difficult session. There are still, I'm sure, issues of broken trust and hurt feelings around a couple policy areas of disagreement. But right now, I think both sides of the aisle are working and have been working to take on some of our toughest challenges, to continue to get resources and aid out to businesses and people across the state, and to prepare our state to withstand the duration of the pandemic as best we can with the tools and resources that we have right now.
Well, the Republicans left the state on February 24th, I believe, and I don't remember exactly what day you shut down the session. The first case of COVID-19 in Oregon was February 28th. So it seems like this is all kind of compressed, and things, when the first case happened in Oregon, I think we were better prepared in a way than they were in Washington with their first case, because we understood what was ahead of us. And I wonder how things shifted for you, both personally and as an elected official, when that first case was announced and you saw what the road ahead could possibly be.
I was at a fundraiser that night when we got notification in advance of the media finding out that Oregon had its first case. It was for the ACLU, actually, the ACLU dinner. I went and found one of my colleagues on the healthcare committee who reached out to her network to figure out where the first patient was being treated. And it became pretty clear that it was a case of community spread, most likely. And at that point, we knew that it was most likely that people were carrying this without exhibiting symptoms, and we were going to have a much bigger problem on our hands. Because Oregon has really modeled nationally what it looks like for community-based care, and my colleagues have been investing in that kind of a system for years and years, we had initially thought, and I still think you're seeing some of that investment pay off here in the state, but we thought we would be better suited to initially prepare and respond. And the governor, actually, the day before we heard that we had received our first case, had already mobilized a response team to respond quickly when and if Oregon had its first case. And so the wheels had already really started turning to mobilize and unify our state response on the healthcare system to this.
You were describing how the very much divided legislature has come together. I want to get a sense of what that looks like and how it's operating now that we have such a bigger thing to come together to fight than we had before, when we were fighting over things. You and I might feel one side about it, and some of the Republicans might feel a different side. What does that look like now?
Well, everything else is on hold, aside from prioritizing the way that we get as best as we can until federal resources and federal aid helps. I'd say, you know, all of the different policy considerations have been put aside in favor of, or not in favor of, it's just the reality of having this unprecedented global health pandemic before us. That has helped us and I think caused us to work together in ways that we probably, Oregonians haven't seen over the last couple of months, when we've been really philosophically on opposite sides of the aisle on a couple of big issues. But right now, you know, as you and I are talking, at least nationally, we're finding out today that there are about 10 million people across the United States who have filed for unemployment. There's a lot of people hurting, and it doesn't matter if you are non-affiliated, Republican or Democrat, or anywhere along your political spectrum. Our focus is on helping people, workers, and small businesses through this incredibly difficult time.
Well, I was reading some articles today about a couple Republican governors, in particular in Georgia and Florida, who were very late to coming to terms with the reality of what this pandemic is about, and who have really resisted ordering stay-at-home orders. I wonder if we're seeing any of that kind of reactiveness and kind of blindly supporting Trump in whatever stand he's taking on any particular moment, if you're seeing any of that within the Oregon legislative body from Republicans, or if you feel like that most Oregon Republicans are starting to see this in the same way that you are.
I think because of our proximity to Washington and how close they are to overwhelming their healthcare system, with just the sheer number of people who are sick with COVID-19, I think it's helped us all to move a lot more quickly and in a lot more unified manner to make sure that we're not overwhelming our urban or our rural healthcare systems. Recall last weekend when a number of Oregonians went to the beach in some areas that are often I'd say purple, you know, for lack of a better word. Those local governments responded quite quickly to ask people to leave and to prohibit overnight stays because they are deeply concerned about overwhelming their capacity in their hospital systems, which are built for the people who are full-time residents there. Around the country, we're also seeing outbreaks in small rural communities where there may only be a couple beds and the next hospital might be a couple hours away. That's just a reality of our healthcare system in the country, and I think it's weighing carefully on all of our minds as we work together in this.
There's a lot of talk now around the country about the particular stress that rural areas are facing with this pandemic. I'm wondering what you're seeing specifically here in Oregon.
Some of the concerns that we've had, of course, legislators have been receiving letters and communications from a number of different business sectors and industries and small business groups to help us better understand what they need to help get through this. For example, not doing a complete shutdown of all sectors was important, particularly for our agricultural and natural resource sectors. You know, our state is still very reliant upon food production, goods production, manufactured goods within those sectors. You know, some of our largest agricultural areas are nurseries, cattle, and others, seed production. A lot of that can be done with social distancing measures in place. And so I think our executive branch has been careful to weigh these concerns and tailoring a policy that's going to work for Oregon, but still allow our rural areas to continue to operate as best they can, because there may be, you know, miles in between each operation. And that's an essential part of making sure that we are still getting food and keeping our food systems in place too. So those kind of where sectors can continue to operate with spatial distance in place, keeping those people working and keeping families employed is something I know our governor has been careful to try to balance and keep going to the greatest extent that we can while still being mindful of health and safety of the general population.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KPFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Karen Power, who's Oregon State Representative for District 41. And a disclosure, she is my personal state representative. One of the things that I don't quite understand in Kate Brown's orders about what is essential and what isn't, that the entire construction industry seems to be allowed to continue. And I'm noticing this with particular interest because there's this building that's been going up in my neighborhood for about a year and a half now, and it's almost finished. And they have been continuing to work since the stay-at-home order. And sometimes they're really in the way of people who are trying to walk down the sidewalk and are really obstructing the ability for pedestrians to social distance from each other, let alone from the construction workers. So I wonder, what is the rationale for allowing this is like a residential and commercial building. It's not an essential building like building a hospital. So what's the rationale for keeping these kinds of construction industries open?
So legislators are on a daily call with the governor's office and some of our public health experts. I think what California has done that, for example, we haven't done is narrowly define essential work. Our governor's team has been approaching it with, can a particular industry or workplace move as much work to telework and working from home as possible? For any work that can't be done from home, it must comply with spatial distancing requirements and OSHA guidelines around keeping surfaces clean and sanitizing and disinfecting things. Because there are a myriad of different types of industries that can continue to operate doing that and keep people employed. And obviously with the skyrocketing unemployment rates that we're already seeing, keeping as many sectors going is going to help our recovery whenever we come out the other end of this pandemic.
But there's been growing stories about several big companies. Intel is one that jumps to my mind. Also, Boeing shut down in California, in Washington. They're still operating here in Oregon. And there's been numerous stories about workers being really concerned because they're not being able to use appropriate social distancing, and they don't have protective clothing, and they're very concerned for their own well-being.
So very few states have shut down the construction industry as a whole because it has such cascading employment effects. I've gotten a couple emails from constituents or possible constituents highlighting that their employers are not providing strict spatial distancing guidance. And there is a new anonymous complaint form that you can fill out with Bully if your employer is not taking the measures they're supposed to be in order to allow this kind of work to continue. If they're not, then they shouldn't be doing that work. But we are in really week two of seeing how this plays out. And I know the governor's office will continue to iterate its guidance and advice. And it's our hope that if, it's my hope that if businesses are continuing to operate, that they're doing so and keeping their workers safe. And if they're not doing that, then we absolutely need their workers to tell us so that our state can take responsive action against them.
Now, how fast is this responsive action going to happen? Because that was one of the concerns. The Oregonian, who does not seem to be a big fan of Kate Brown or of Oregon Democrats, for that matter, has written a number of critical articles. But one was raised concerns that workers were raising concerns and raising them at the state level, but there was some concern about whether this, how fast the state was going to respond to the complaints.
So I think it'll be up to two things to happen. One, you know, as legislators, we'll be raising this in our communications with the executive branch to let them know that we're hearing. That's part of the purpose of our daily briefing calls and communication. We also need leaders within the industry to step up and make clear that this is unacceptable. But I think the last data I saw was there was at least over 1,000 complaints in the first week to Bully. And I'm sure our executive branch is looking at that data to see whether there are common issues among industry sectors and maybe specifically tailoring more specific guidance or instruction or executive orders may be warranted in the days ahead.
Well, one of the interesting industry responses, we're getting far away from construction and now we're going to garments and outdoor equipment. Tim Boyle, who's the CEO of Columbia Sportswear, has said he's taking a $10,000 salary for the year. He's keeping all of his employees on salary with their full medical benefits. They're probably in a better position than some other companies are to do this, but I wonder if that can be a model. Do you think there's a way to model that for more businesses to start thinking about ways to really keep their employees on salary and in a way that would really help to keep their businesses alive through this period?
I hope so. I think we've seen other businesses step up and do similar things, or staff have taken a pay cut across the board in order to make sure that seasonal staff can stay on or have some sort of benefits. I think it's been pretty amazing to see how both organizational leadership and employees have stepped up in generous and unexpected ways. Full disclosure, you know, Tim Boyle is on the board of the nonprofit I work for, but the model that he is emulating for Portland companies to follow is an incredibly generous one. You know, we're seeing other enormously large donations to the Oregon Food Bank and other philanthropic sectors who have been hit by this get some sustaining donations from business leaders in our community. I think that kind of generosity brings out the best in all of us and helps people who are struggling or have been laid off understand that there are businesses that still care about their workers out there.
Well, I got another picture of this yesterday. I ran into my neighbor who is also owns the auto mechanics garage that I take my car to. And he was talking about how he's had to lay off a lot of his employees. I mean, they're still taking in cards. They're doing very careful social distancing, both in their plant and also the way they relate to their customers. People still need to get their cars fixed. So it's another one of those essential industries. And I got the sense as I was talking to him, he's like doing the best he can. And what he's hoping for is with the government assistance from the federal government that's going to be coming down, that he's hoping he can take advantage of that and hire his staff back and keep them at home. Another icon of Portland that really concerns me is Powell's Books. And I understand things are not quite as bleak in the view of their owner, Emily Powell, as it was when she first sent out a letter to all the employees telling him why she was laying off about 80% of them. I'm wondering if businesses like Powell's, like My Mechanic, like a lot of other small businesses in Portland who have laid off their staff, will be able to take advantage of the government assistance and be able to hire back their staff.
That's the purpose of these small business loans, most of which under certain criteria may be eligible for forgiveness. But the purpose of these loans are to allow small businesses to hire their workers back on payroll. The loans are eligible for insurance, for payroll, for healthcare, and other essential costs to keep people going, to help us get through the next couple months. And then we'll see what Congress envisions as a, you know, a next phase of assistance if we need it. We are at the legislative state level, because this is coming down from the federal level, we are getting briefed, I think today or tomorrow, on how these loans are going to flow through to our banks or become available, and how people are going to be able to apply for them directly. So we should have information on that in each of our legislative newsletters, likely, you know, on the state website through Business Oregon and through other resources, so we can get the word out to small businesses how they can access these dollars as quickly as possible once they've been dispersed.
Well, one of the frustrations with dealing with what's coming out of the federal government is the tune keeps changing from day to day. And when the $2 trillion package was passed last week, and there was very clear oversight for that $500 billion that's going to big industries as opposed to small industries, then Trump a few days later said, no, I'm the one who's going to have the final say on how it goes. And I guess that's being debated. I'm not sure where that argument is going to settle. But it does seem like it's really hard to trust the feds at this point, that they're going to follow through with anything good that they even that they give lip service to. How does Oregon interface with that? And it seems like Oregon and a lot of other states, Washington and California for sure, and New York, many other states are doing the best on the local level to do what they feel is right. But how do you interface with the feds, particularly when there's this money coming through, to make sure that the federal government does what they said they're going to do?
Well, Barbara, I can't tell you how many conference calls everybody has every day, but they're an enormous amount. Our federal delegation has been front and center in pushing for good governance and oversight of this multi-trillion dollar relief package. I'm confident our senators and their team of superb staff will continue to push for making sure these dollars go to businesses that need them. And I know there's been questions of whether we should be bailing out, for example, the cruise ship industry when so many of those industries are not registered here in the United States and are elsewhere for tax avoidance purposes, for example.
I read an article the other day about how at least most of the cruise ship lines are not eligible. And it was kind of the irony. This is what happens when you, you know, go for a tax shelter somewhere else and then you want to get money from the U.S. government. What does that say about some of these industries, particularly the ones that Trump seems to really be supporting, because he's a big backer of those cruise ship lines? What does it say about this disconnect between doing what's good for their bottom line and doing what's good for humanity?
I think it's a testament to the number of Americans who are paying attention right now and advocating for clear and transparent use of these dollars, and also reaching out and making their voices heard when things are not going to be working. So I heard that too, you know, the cruise industry shouldn't be receiving any or shouldn't be eligible for these dollars. But, you know, for example, some of the stimulus payments that are coming directly to individuals and families, there were originally strings attached that you needed to have filed a tax return already. Well, that doesn't make any sense when our tax return deadline has both been extended and you might be an individual, a person on fixed income, or a senior who doesn't file a tax return anymore because you don't have tax liability. I think thanks to the outcry and swift attention that received, they've changed direction at the federal level on that within the last, I think, 24 hours or a little bit more.
Yeah, I saw that, and it was very encouraging, actually. And it makes me think about what else can we really put pressure on? It just seems that we are seeing a level of engagement, ironically, in this time of social isolation, where perhaps we have more leverage than we ever had before.
Yeah, in a time of crisis, I think it is bringing out, I think it's causing us to really look at who are our frontline workers who need to be supported in these times. And it is our most marginalized communities and our workforce whose work has not been valued like this ever before. I mean, the focus on the number of grocery store workers who are asking for improved safety practices. I mean, it's just, I think I've never seen across the board so many workers come together to advocate for better practices, hazard pay, and other things to make their working conditions safer for them and their families to engage in. But, you know, where would we be right now without our grocery workers and our nurses, our doctors, our janitors who are cleaning our hospitals and other essential spaces?
Our garbage collectors.
I know. I was just going to say our garbage collectors.
Yeah.
These really are the essential pillars of our society. And I think their work is being valued in a new way right now that will have lasting consequences in the way that we consider in the years to come.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Karen Power, who's the Oregon State Representative for District 41. It's interesting when we talk about who these frontline workers are. And at first, we were just hearing about the healthcare workers. And interestingly, the doctors weren't the only ones we were talking about. We were talking a lot about the nurses. We were talking about all the technicians, all the lower paid people in the medical field who are the ones who are at most risk of being contaminated. But what I really love now is that we're putting grocery workers and delivery people and garbage collectors and janitors in that same class and realizing that these are the people, as you just said, who really keep our society together. How do you see this maybe building into a larger workers' movement in the aftermath of this pandemic?
I think you're seeing unprecedented worker organizing across gig economy workers, shift workers, and others. I mean, much of that unseen labor, warehouses, people who are classified as independent contractors to do delivery work, have common ground in this and are gaining the appreciation of the American people in a way that I think we've never seen before. So many things that we've taken for granted that make life normal for us has been turned upside down. And those people have really been struggling to get benefits, to be heard, to be seen, to protect their families and earn a living wage. And, you know, I don't know about you, but it's caused me to think about, like, what are the people who are making my day-to-day existence right now possible? It's the folks who are repairing stuff if it breaks, and the people who are caring for our sick, and the people who are keeping us fed, and the people who get it, you know, are moving our food and goods from point A to point B. I think, you know, we've had in the younger generations a resurgence around union movements and better living conditions. But I think that will be front and center in our policy nationally at the state level in the aftermath of how we come out after this pandemic, and a greater appreciation for this work that has been taken for granted. And, you know, I'd add teachers, preschool workers. I have an almost 4-year-old, and man, I mean, he misses his school and his teachers so much. We've always, I think, you know, many of us have always been grateful, but never to this degree of the people who are making our lives still possible and keeping that vague sense of normalcy and, you know, making sure our garbage gets collected and that we still have, you know, water to turn on and flush the toilets and all that stuff, keeping our energy and our electricity on. Really, I think for many of us are the basics.
During the Great Depression of the 30s, that was really the boom time for labor union organizing. I wonder if you see a parallel between what came out of the Depression in the 30s and what could be coming out as a result of what is teetering on an actual depression right now as a result of this pandemic.
Yeah, I think we're well into it. I mean, there's nationally, economists are telling us that there's no way we come out of this without some sort of a recession. There's just no way our economy can bounce back instantaneously, turn the switch back on, and act like, you know, all of this didn't happen. At the federal level, I think the next bill that I've heard they're considering is some sort of a works project to help people get back to work over a period of years. I've been wondering, too, if we'll see that happen in arts, music, and other artistic forms, because so many of us are also finding solace online in creativity. I'm thinking too, my wife showed me a post yesterday where one of our museums in the United States asked people to recreate famous works of art at home. And it was just hysterical. People dressing up in whatever they could find to emulate national, national art and others, including dressing up their dogs or their kids. I think we're really making space now in our day-to-day lives for things that bring us beauty and hope. I think of how the Roaring Twenties came after the Great Depression as well, and wonder what this will help us focus on and how we support our arts organizations and embrace and celebrate music and other craft together.
Well, that was another thing that was great about the Depression. Well, not great about the Depression, but the New Deal of Roosevelt was there was so much support for the arts and some really amazing works of art came out as a result of that. Kind of, what are you envisioning? What do you see could be some of the artistic creations that would be a result if there were good central government funding for the arts as a result of this pandemic?
That's a great question, because I know so much of that funding has been cut. I don't know. I think it'll matter. What are our new priorities coming out of this? You know we have worse days ahead. And as we climb out of that, I think we'll value medicine in ways that we have not. And I think we'll value people who are helping to create things to bring joy and light and enjoyment into our houses after this. I think it'll also lead to new collaboration between artists. And I was watching Yo-Yo Ma, who started a nightly performance on Facebook, collaborating with a children's book author, who my son loves, last night as we were getting ready for bed. Not being from that community myself, I don't know, but it is part of, I think art has always been an intrinsic part of our culture and who we are as people. I hope that it receives due recognition in future stimulus work as well at the federal level, because so many artists right now are sharing their work for free online with us to bring a little joy into our lives as we're, so many of us are isolating at home. And it's a real gift.
Well, one of the things that's been really interesting to me, just as the shutdown started and stay-at-home orders were came into force in a lot of states a couple of weeks ago, all the late-night TV programs basically went dark. At least I watched a couple of them, and it was watching like Stephen Colbert with an audience of his crew in an otherwise empty auditorium and drinking. It looked like he was drinking Jack Daniels as he was doing his bit. It was a very, I thought, kind of moving thing of watching him processing what was about to happen. And he and a number of other late night people just kind of went off the air for a couple of weeks. And then they started coming back. And first it was like filming from their iPad in their house in very, very funky things. And now they're getting the technology up a little bit better, but they're still basically doing these do-it-yourself, do-it-at-home kinds of shows. And I was watching Stephen Colbert's last couple shows last night and thinking about how I was going to be doing my own do-it-at-home radio show today. And it's interesting to watch some of our icons, our cultural icons at home. Stephen Colbert insists on wearing a suit still, at least from the top up. And he did a very funny interview, actually, with John Oliver. And John Oliver was in his sweats, and he's looking really pretty strung out. And he's got two very young children, and his situation's quite different than Stephen Colbert's. But watching these people who we've always had a distance with, now seeing them coming from their homes, and it just makes me think about, in a way, how it inspires people to do things for themselves. And for those of us in community radio, learning how to produce our shows at home. Do you see like a kind of resilience that can come out of this?
I do. Well, I do and I don't, because I think I was looking at an article probably last week. It's hard to remember exactly what day I read it now. Where this is drawing out really our class divide. And I think for those of us who have time at home and are trying to do so many different jobs all at once, teaching our kids, parenting, working, that's one experience. Our minimum wage workers or gig economy workers are having a different experience. My hope is that with the federal relief package, it will help to provide support for our lowest income Oregonians that are really, really struggling with how do they keep a roof over their head. Thankfully, now we have an eviction moratorium for both residential and commercial spaces. But it is drawing out, I think, parallels in our humanity across socioeconomic lines. But for those of us who are staying at home, and that is the experience. My wife is a teacher. I work for a nonprofit. We're able to do our work remotely, and we're at home with our young son. We're trying to figure out how do we reuse things that we have already to minimize going out and buying anything new. And I think that sort of DIY ethic, absolutely. I bought some more seeds online so I could do some more gardening this spring and this summer. And one of my favorite seed companies is almost totally out of everything, which tells me that there are way more people out there trying to teach themselves how to be more resilient. I think we saw there's a boom in chick buying this spring. That's very Portland, of course, but it sounds like it's happening nationally as people are figuring out and wanting to be more resilient in their own food systems and in their day-to-day needs.
I have to admit, I've been going to the grocery store more than I should, but we have a very friendly neighborhood grocery store, and they're doing pretty good job of social distancing. But one of the concerns I have is buying greens, and the first time I had to buy a bunch of lettuce, once this all started, I started thinking, I can't wait till my garden's in and I can just go out to my garden and pick my lettuce and my spinach and I don't have to go to the store anymore. So I think that is a really, unfortunately in Oregon, this is not really a great time to be planting a lot of things. And probably we won't be able to do that for a few more weeks. But I think that it does kind of get back to that whole idea. And again, it reminds me of back in the 30s and 40s, particularly during World War II with the Victory Gardens. And do you see maybe ways that you think this is just kind of being generated from the grassroots? Or do you think there's also ways that the state can help to encourage people to do these kinds of resourceful, resilient kinds of actions?
I think Oregonians were like that anyway. And I say that as somebody who grew up in New Jersey, where backyard food gardens weren't really a thing. I'm sure they are more than when I was growing up. But I think that is true of our state. We're an incredibly resilient people. We're very, a very independent people. But we're also, we draw together tightly in times of need. And I think we're seeing our small business sectors, like Business for a Better Portland, lead in gathering information and getting resources out to businesses across the Portland metropolitan area if they need them. And there has been this organic, not in just the gardening sense, but this organic community online that has sprung up in finding out ways to sustain each other, both culturally and socially, and in terms of food, that still complies with spatial distancing, but helps people to just get through these next couple months until we get a clearer sense of getting a handle on the pandemic.
Well, I did see some encouraging news today, and it looks like the rate of infection in Oregon is slowing down. Do you know anything about that? I mean, is that something we should take heart in, or do we still need to be pretty wary?
I would say the signs are encouraging that spatial distancing is working, which means that we need to commit to it even more now than people were within the last couple of weeks. There were some models coming out yesterday from our health experts that the curve that we've been trying to flatten, that originally looked as though we were going to hit peak hospitalization towards the end of April. It looks like that may now happen in early May. That is a great sign that we're not going to exceed. If we continue on this trajectory of everybody being very cautious, staying at home and minimizing community contact, that we may be able to avoid overwhelming our hospital system and spreading the disease much faster. So it appears that we're working. That does not mean that people can go hiking altogether anymore, right away.
And those trails are closed.
Yeah, we still need to stay committed to complying with the governor's spatial distancing order and staying home.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Karen Power, who's Oregon State Representative for District 41. I'm actually finding that the more we get deeper and deeper into this new reality, that I'm finding ways that I'm accepting it. I'm not so, like, by the time they announced that all the trails in, I guess across the country in national forests, but definitely in the Northwest, that they're all closed, I had made a decision myself that, no, I'm not going to go hiking during this. And for several reasons, one being that if I want to hike with somebody and we have to drive separate cars to go 50, 60 miles, that's not a very good use of gas. I also just started feeling uneasy wanting, you know, thinking about being that far from home and being, it just seemed like really need to stay home. I'm also discovering now this upside where our socializing is seeing our neighbors from our sidewalk and talking to them on their front porches. And we're having deeper and deeper conversations with a lot of our neighbors and really getting to know them and becoming much deeper friends. And then with our good friends that we don't live near, we're talking on the phone with them a lot more and having incredible conversations. So I feel that in some ways, social distancing can really make us closer. And I wonder if you're having an experience at all like that.
It's balanced. You know, I think my wife and I, her parents live just up in Seattle, but we are not going to be seeing them for the foreseeable future. That's really hard on our almost four-year-old. He really misses his grandparents. So we talk to them at least once a day, if not a couple times a day. For him, because he's so little, that is not going to be a full replacement of the physical and social contact that he's used to with them or his friends from preschool, who he misses tremendously. But for the, you know, for us as adults, I think we are beginning to adapt to, you know, the new normal that we're living in right now. I don't know about you. I have good days and bad days where I'm, you know, just really frustrated. I find that those are the days where I didn't get up and move enough or pay attention to being outside or getting some fresh air, you know, where I'm on back-to-back work calls all day. I read a great article in the Chronicle of Higher Education from a woman who's a professor who's reported from war-torn areas where we're all going to have good days and bad days because we don't have clarity on how long this will last. And that's just part of the nature of the global pandemic. Until then, you know, wherever we are on days that we are accepting it and days that we're not, we just have to be really kind to ourselves. And give ourselves a little bit of grace. This is a completely different experience than all of us had been living just a month ago, and it takes our brains a bit to get used to it. Being outside and getting some fresh air is, I think, one of the best things we can all make sure we're doing every day.
Yeah, I definitely have been experiencing that myself. I had this thought the other day. I was just thinking about how this is like the hardest thing anybody can live through, and I thought, no, it's not. This is not nearly as devastating as living through a war. And what it actually made me think about was that much more empathy with people in war zones, and then thinking the worst thing you can be doing is living in a war zone during a pandemic, as many people around the world are. So I wonder how that opens us up in terms of deepening our empathy.
Yeah, that was my thought too. We're each going to be experiencing this differently. For those of us who are fortunate enough to have a safe living environment, it allows us space to be thinking about new levels of empathy. But, you know, our neighbor next door, we may not know, is not living in a safe environment. So I think deepening our social connectivity so we can help each other and look for signs of people who are going to be struggling alone more than they would be when they had access to resources is going to be part of how we all get through this. Certainly, it could always be worse. But I don't want to minimize how difficult it really is for people who are struggling, who might be total social extroverts and are having a really hard time being at home, you know, with just a handful of people all the time. Psychologically, it's a complete 180 from our lives just a couple weeks ago. And I think we'll find empathy in all kinds of new ways for each other.
Well, one last thing. I want to get back to where we started this conversation, and that's about this progressive agenda that we were heading towards back in February that got derailed. And I'm wondering, how do we continue to work for the things that are so important in the post COVID-19 world. And I'm thinking in particular about protecting the Northwest from some very destructive fossil fuel projects that still lurk and whose supporters have found ways to try to slip things in while we're all distracted by the pandemic. In particular, I'm thinking about the Jordan Cove, the FERC decision to allow the permitting for Jordan Cove. But I wonder if how we see the other things. You were been engaged in some very exciting potential legislation for the next session that would really protect Oregon from the dangers of high-pressure oil trains and other things besides that. How do you see that we move ahead and we keep thinking about the things that we need to work for at the same time that we're trying to get through this pandemic?
You know, if we're not seeing a lot of external media on it, is because so many people are just grappling with adjusting to what their life is and how it was different from, you know, yesterday and the day before. That aside, there are many of us still keeping an eye on rule changes at the federal level. You know, as we've discussed before, as chair of our Oregon House Energy and the Environment Committee, my role is to work with our National Caucus of Environmental Legislators and keep an eye on federal changes and how they might impact our state work as well. I just co-authored a letter to the EPA that we're circulating right now among some of our state colleagues, pushing, you know, asking the EPA to reconsider its decision to suspend enforcement for the duration of the pandemic, for example. So I think once, now that we're getting a little bit more of a systems handle on approaching the pandemic, and at least here in Oregon, we have social distancing measures in place and a lot of the key framework in place right now to be responsive. That's allowing us time to keep an eye on protecting our people in different ways and making sure that our air and water remains clean and healthy for people to breathe going forward, especially with the way that we're seeing COVID-19 impact people's lungs. Clean air is going to be paramount. And in terms of our progressive agenda, I think it's too early to know what it's going to look like for a 2021 session or for work at the congressional level, but it's going to cause us to reexamine the ways that we are protecting people and their health. And, you know, I want to be mindful that we're not clear on how this is going to impact Oregon's budget yet. That will become clear over the coming weeks. But as a state that is predominantly reliant upon personal income taxes, it won't be good. So it'll cause us to have to, you know, retool our focus a bit and really prioritize people and center people in our policies and our work. I think that'll produce some great policies in protecting our communities, but it may mean we have less dollars than we did a month ago.
I wonder if there's any way that we can start getting those billionaire and multimillionaire taxes through, if there's going to be any change of heart amongst the people that have been fighting added taxes for people who could really afford it to help support those who can't.
Yeah, and I think a key part of our work would be the business tax. There's been a number of different calls from different sectors to suspend business taxes across the board right now, but we know that not all businesses are going through this experience alike. Some are booming right now because they're supplying things that people need in ways that they haven't needed to the same degree before. And there's other businesses right now that are really hurting. So our policies, you know, in the year ahead are not going to be a one-size-fits-all because people, small businesses and large businesses, you know, and across our socioeconomic spectrum, people are experiencing this very, very differently. So we'll need to take that into account for our policies next year.
So what do you plan to do in the near future just to kind of get through this, both as an individual human being and also as an elected representative?
I think my colleagues and I are figuring out the ways that we can plug into the subject areas that we have expertise in and help sustain those. So as the youngest parent in the legislature, I've been working with our agencies at the state level that help regulate and support childcare, because I see that in my day job with my coworkers. So many of us have kids in care who are now taking care of them at home. There's no way that we as a society can get back to any kind of a normal experience without our birth to pre-K system being stood up at the same time that we reactivate our K-12 systems. in our higher education systems. But that's a piece that I've been looking to. And then especially around insurance and a couple of some smaller things. I think the data is telling us it's going to last, you know, at least for another couple more months until we see we need more testing. We need to be able to do more community testing before we can loosen some of these social distancing requirements. So assuming that nationally states are beginning to implement social distancing, like we saw Florida, I think, yesterday, we'll have a wave of reaction to keeping people safe and trying to stem the flow of the pandemic before we really get a handle on it nationally. I think in the meantime, for me and my wife, the idea of us working, you know, 8 to 5 is out the window. We're figuring out how to stagger our schedules so that she can teach and so that I can work for my nonprofit and do my legislative job at the same time. And that's requiring us to figure out how to parent our kid differently, who's been in a Spanish immersion program. I think that we'll continue to have some rough days, but people are adjusting to whatever the reality looks like right now and trying to make the best of it, the best that we can. And we've got a couple of weeks before we see really the impact of the federal aid coming through. And then we'll be advocating, I'll be advocating for my district to see if we need more resources for people after that initial cash infusion is up. I don't think $1,200 a person is nearly enough. I have friends abroad whose countries are providing much more cash support to help people get through this. It's great to have a rent and mortgage moratorium available for people who need it, but day-to-day cash needs are much more than just $1,200 a month. So
everybody recognizes that one, I think. Actually, I like Bernie Sanders' idea of $2,000 a month for every household, every individual. Well, Karen, it's really good to talk to you. I wish you the best as you, like the rest of us, work our way through this very unfamiliar reality that we're living in. And I'm really glad that we have elected officials like you and so many others, as we're discovering in Oregon, who are really stepping up. So thanks a whole lot for joining us. And I hope we talk again soon.
Same here. Be well. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. And you be well, too. Bye-bye. Today, we've been talking with Karen Power, Oregon State Representative for District 41, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll talk with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper about all the sneaky things the fossil fuel industry is trying to do while we're in the midst of a pandemic. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. We're going to go with some music by Sting. Stay safe and wash your hands.
missiles and wars, the towers rise, and numberless floors in space. I could shed another million tears, a million breaths, a million names, but only one truth to face. Single truth, a single light, a single thought, a singular touch of God.